This is David A. Goodman, writer and one of the executive producers for The Orville, and you're listening to Discoville on the Fandom Podcast Network.
Welcome to Discoville, where we discuss both Star Trek Discovery and The Orville here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we take an in-depth look at each of these shows and discover that both of them can coexist in today's fandom as they introduce us to fresh, new, and exciting stories, characters, galactic destinations, and so much more. I'm Norm, one of your co-pilots here on Discoville, but you know I don't do this alone. With me in the co-pilot seat this week is the Raider nerd himself, wearing all of his Raider gear, because I can see him, you can't, and I think I count maybe, 10 patches on him that say the Raiders. He's my fellow co-host on Blood of Kings, the Highlander podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Kevin, I have so many Raider patches, Reitzel, and you don't. How are you, Kevin?
I'm doing really good. It's actually kind of fitting that as of this recording, the sale for TeePublic for anything that you want to get up there, including Fandom Podcast Network logos, I'm going to be ordering my Discoville t-shirt.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, and it kind of fits for the show that we're getting ready to talk about, too. So
I think so, because it's all about style. It's all about style. And speaking of style, back with us here in the tactical chair for Discoville is the co-founder with much style of the Fandom Podcast Network and co-host on the Stylish Culture Clash and the Stylish End Zone, Mr. Kyle Wagner. Hey, Kyle. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Norman. And first of all, I know I'm not aesthetically as pleasing as our last two tactical guests, but I will do my best for you guys. And two, could each of you move over just a half inch either direction? I just want to get you centered on the video.
There we go. Sorry about that. Sorry.
Too much dead space? Is that kind of screwing with your view screen?
I just can't have that conversation.
Well, we got a lot to get to on this show. This is going to be a fun show. So before we jump into the main topic, Kevin, would you mind opening up hailing frequencies and let everyone know how they can get in touch with us here on the Fandom Podcast Network and on Discoville?
It would be my pleasure. You can always find Discoville on these subspace channels on our main page on the Fandom Podcast Network on podbean.com at fpnet.podbean.com. You can stream all of our shows there as well as Discoville. You can also find the FPNet on the Podbean app. Fandom Podcast Network can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play for your Android users. We're on Twitter at DiscovillePod, and now we're on Instagram at DiscovillePod. Please make sure you go to Twitter and also Instagram and follow us there, and we'll follow you back. Also, you can find more on Facebook, the Fandom Podcast Network, and also the Discoville Facebook page, which is a closed group, but we'd love to get you on there, so make sure you come in there and join the Discoville family. If you'd like to contact us directly, you can hail us through the Fandom Podcast Network at gmail.com or Discoville directly at discovillepodcast@gmail.com. I'm Kevin, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. Norm, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Starfighter1701 and on Instagram at SoCalSwordFighter. That's SOCAL, Swordfighter.
Kyle, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at AKyleW and on Instagram at AKyleFandom.
And as I mentioned earlier, too, please visit our TeePublic store that we're in partnership with, and you can help support the Fandom Podcast Network when you purchase one of our shirts up there and any of our other items as well. You can get many of our awesome logos on many other like T-shirts and tank tops and cups and binders and a bunch of cool stuff, and you support us when you do that. Just go to tpublica.com and search for Fandom Podcast Network. And yes, we do have the awesome Discoville logo done by our good co-founder and friend of the show here, Mr. Norman Seelau. So make sure you pick that up. And of course, we would love some reviews on iTunes. Please go to iTunes and search the Fandom Podcast Network. And if you want to mention Discoville and say, tell us how we're doing, please mention that in the review. We'd love to hear from you.
Awesome, Kevin. Thank you so much for that. And now we're going to jump into the main topic. The title for this episode here is Designs of Future Past, because we wanted to talk about some of the things that were really important to us as fans. And in fandom, we love looking at great design work, great costumes, and great props, because those are the things that really drive us as fans to get into and immerse ourselves into the shows that we love. And I know that we usually talk about episodes on Discoville, but you know, Kevin and Kyle and I, we've had these discussions before, and we were kind of a little slightly concerned about, well, what do we have to talk about when there's not episodes to talk about? But there's so much to talk about between Discovery and the Orville, and I think that something that's been a hot button topic on our Facebook page and across social media is how good the production level is on both of these shows. So, I mean, between costumes and props and set designs and the music and just the general production on both shows. But we're just going to talk about, on this show, the costumes and props that were inspired loosely by, I would say, the original series and somewhat Enterprise-esque for Discovery. And I'd probably say somewhere in the next generation in that era of 90s science fiction for the Orville. But I'm not saying that they're direct lifts, but they were definitely inspired by those eras of television that we love. So it's time to relax and unzip those uniform jackets, because we're going off duty as we head into the officer's lounge. So boldly going into design, that's kind of one of the topics I wanted to talk about, because when it comes to Star Trek, icons are everything. The uniforms are everything. They define what the show is, and they define kind of like the tenor and the world building of the show. It's probably the most daunting task to try and bring any new design vision to any Star Trek. I mean, from the original series to Next Generation, and Herman Zimmerman, I mean, we're all fans of what Herman Zimmerman did, Doug Drexler, Michael and Denise Okuda. They brought the visual design aesthetic from the Next Generation to Deep Space Nine, to Voyager, and into Enterprise. And that's when everything kind of ended for Star Trek. So now you have a new crew of people, new production designers, new costume designers, new prop designers, and creating a universe in the canon of a pre-existing prime timeline in 2255, 10 years before Kirk takes over command of the Enterprise in 2265, that's got to be tough. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is the uniforms. Kind of not being uniform with the uniforms that we know. I'd like to read a little bit of Gersha Phillips' background. Now, she is the Discovery's costume designer. And I'm borrowing a little bit of what I'm reading from StarTrek.com from an article that they wrote early on in Discovery called Behind the Scenes, Discovery Costumes. On designing costumes for Star Trek Discovery, she said, "It's the best playground you could ever have to design and create in," she raved. And the other question that was posed to her, but does she ever feel constrained by the franchise's long history and all of the many costumes that preceded her creations? And I wanted to actually emphasize this point. She says, well, definitely, because you're always looking to what's happened in the past and what has been established in other shows, Phillips replied. But I think the mandate from the showrunner, and at this time it would have been Brian Fuller, was to go boldly where no one's gone before. Did I just say that? So yeah, I feel like it was definitely a push to do something great and something different. And I think especially with the Klingons and with the Vulcans. So it brought up a little bit of a controversy when they started leaking out this information. One of the things I wanted to ask you guys first, Kevin, let's start with you first. Were Discovery's uniforms and especially the redefining of the Klingons, were these things that initially shocked you? Or did you come to accept this as a brand new vision for Discovery?
When it comes to the crew of the Discovery, nothing really shocking there. I was really surprised, though, how, you know, they seemed comfortable, very slimline. I love the piping on the uniforms as well. Of course, with the different badges, of course, they have on there. And they just, it looks good. Everything looked really, really kind of sleek and slender, and I really liked how they looked overall. And I really liked those medical uniforms, the white ones. Thought those really popped. The ones that I had a little getting used to was the Klingons, you know, because there was a lot of like edges and stuff like that. I just got like, man, that guy, that's got to be comfortable or uncomfortable for Klingons to fight in. But when I started looking at the detail and how much was put into that, I started to appreciate them a lot more, especially when you started seeing the actors behind the makeup and the costumes doing quite a wonderful job playing their roles in these things. But everything with the details and the patterns of, you know, of everything regarding the uniforms, they've just put so much time and effort into it, even to like Spock's uniform and what he was wearing. I'm sorry, Sarek, Spock's father. Just all of that stuff. It's one of the things that has really stood out. And, you know, even down to the shoes, you know, just little things like that. And the shoes that Saru has, because not sure exactly how his feet are, but they're kind of like on a little, you know, kind of like a high heel shoe type of setup. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it still allows the actor to be comfortable and to move around quite well.
Kyle, what did you think of the uniforms when you first saw them? One of the things I have to give Star Trek Discovery a lot of credit for is that during their social media campaign, they started kind of parsing out this information in really nice, methodical, and consistent dribs and drabs so that I think people weren't jarred with seeing something new. When you started seeing these previews, what did you think, and did you feel like you were comfortably sliding into a new universe?
You know, that's a great point, Norman, because I think that's one of the things Discovery did very well was kind of prepare people for what they were going to see. And, you know, I was a huge fan of these uniforms when they revealed them. I liked the design. It's very, like Kevin said, it's very sleek. It's a very stylish design. And I think the dark blue with the gold really pops. And then when you mix in, like, the black deltas at times too, I think that's just a great look for that. And I'm with Kevin too, as far as the medical, the white, just, it's such a great standout. You know, this is going to sound a little weird to some people, but you know, I see the color palette in this show that they use on the uniforms, and it kind of takes me back to Tron in an aspect where you have these interesting costume designs that we've never really seen, especially when you saw the leap from the original Tron to Tron Legacy. I kind of felt that way about Discovery and the way they designed the costumes with a different look, but it still does a justice to where it came from.
I mean, you have such a very specific design palette with the original series because, again, we're taking this show 10 years before the original series happened. And when you see the original series, especially with the cage, because this is supposed to be around the time of Captain Christopher Pike and the cage and the launching, well, not the launching, but, you know, the Enterprise kind of in its infancy, the uniform colors that you saw in the cage were command, gold, mustard. That kind of didn't change. But then you had the medical sciences, which were a little bit lighter of a blue. And then you had security, which wasn't the quote unquote, the red shirts that you know. They were more of kind of like this rust, this light rust kind of color. And they introduced those subtly into some of the design elements of these blue uniforms. So I felt that they were kind of bringing Enterprise up a little bit, which was a series that wasn't really that widely respected in the fan communities and started to incorporate a little bit of the original series cage colors into this design aesthetic. But one of the things I didn't want to gloss over too much here were the designs for the Klingons, because yes, Federation uniforms get subtly changed here and there, but the Klingons were radically redesigned. So, Kyle, when you started seeing some of these new Klingon prosthetics and the way that they were costumed and the armor and the batleths and the mechleths, what did you think about this? You're like, wow, they're really going for it, or, oh, this is not going to go well with the fan community. How did you feel?
You know what? I felt both ways because I actually really liked the look. I liked the fact that they were going bold, making the Klingons look a little more alien in that aspect. And I also kind of looked at it as we have the technology within our makeup and within our special effects to make this Klingon look. But I also knew that a lot of fans were going to be very upset with this new look for the Klingons. You know, there's one thing about Star Trek fans more than any other. They are very traditional. They want their tradition. They want to see that. And sometimes they don't accept change really well. And I think what I'm so curious about this is with Discovery, I think eventually we're going to lead into something that explains why the Klingons went from the look that we see in Discovery to the more familiar look we are of Klingons. And I think that's going to be a great story that's going to be told later on in Discovery. And I think this is where the Star Trek community needs to have a little patience and see let the story go and see what they're going to do with the Klingons going forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. And Kevin, in our previous episode, in episode 8, we were talking about some of our favorite things. And one of the things you mentioned that you liked a lot about any Star Trek iteration, you're a huge fan of the Klingons. So I know that you enjoyed them in TNG when they kind of like got redone a little bit there, you know, with Worf and Kern, the House of Moog, you know, and how that progressed on into Gowron and into the Klingons that we saw in Deep Space Nine and moving forward. And they didn't really change all that much, but and even they changed a little bit in the Abrams universe. But this was really turning the Klingon Empire like kind of like on its own design aesthetic. I mean, we went so far out there to make them look alien. How did you feel about it? Because I know how much you like the Klingon designs.
Well, at first it was caught me off guard. I know a lot of fans were kind of turned off by it. And wondering like what's going on? Why are they kind of reinventing the look and making them look like, you know, really alien? But you know, I had an open mind, and I'm kind of curious to see if this is explained and something happens, and we kind of we'll see other different types of Klingons, kind of like what you know. What Kyle was talking about, but, you know, whether that happens or not right now, that doesn't bother me anymore. I've grown accustomed to him, and a lot has to do with it, with the actors behind them. When you really start to invest in the characters and how they're playing them, you kind of forget, you know, what, you know, you were feeling about it originally because you're getting emotionally invested into these characters and how well the actors are portraying them. And that's how I feel right now. I'm kind of excited to see what's going to happen with the Klingons.
I am too. And I think that you're right, Kyle. I think that a lot of us as Star Trek fans, we have to exercise a lot of patience because we don't know really where the context of the Klingon Empire is right now. So we're just going to have to wait and see and see what happens as the second half of the series unfolds after January 8th. But one of the things I also wanted to talk about, and I'm going to spoiler alert this because I'm not sure how many people actually have read or have listened to the audiobook of this, but David Mack, his first novel called Desperate Hours, which was the first extension of Star Trek Discovery, even though it took place before all of these events that you see on the series take place, he tried to explain away the differences between the uniforms and the technology when he paired up his characters on the USS Shenzo, like Burnham and Saru and Captain Georgiou, with events that were happening in this story with Captain Christopher Pike and Number One and Spock. And the characters were paired logically to the story, but there was something that he wrote in there saying that the original Constitution-class heavy cruisers, which were the most advanced ships of that time, had the look that we're most accustomed to seeing from the cage moving forward with the multicolored uniforms and the phasers and communicators and all of that as we've seen them. Well, actually, there were laser pistols in the cage. But the technology that we saw there, because they had the best, most advanced, top-of-the-line equipment, and say everything else in Starfleet had the look of the Shenzo and eventually the Discovery. How do you feel about that? Do you buy that? Kevin, do you buy that as a good explanation for how the division is between these two worlds?
Yeah, I guess to a certain point. And, you know, I could see where he's going at with that. And, you know, I'm fine with that. I think it's a clever way to do it. And, you know, I'm open to all of these suggestions. And as long as it, you know, somewhat kind of feels like it can happen and it feels comfortable. So, yeah.
I mean, Kyle, does it make sense to you? Is it kind of like throwing a Hail Mary and hopefully the fans will accept it? Or do you think that it's just the best attempt possible to make sense of something that is really kind of divided?
I think it's a no-win situation because I think no matter what you do, you're going to have a section of the fandom that's going to be unhappy. They want things a certain way. And again, it goes back to just Trek fans being, they want it the way they see it. And it's one of the things that frustrates me with, because I think Discovery is a great show bringing such a new vibe to such a great universe in Star Trek. And I think it goes back to damned if you do, damned if you don't. He can throw the Hail Mary and hope, or he's got a plan, but either way, he's not going to please everybody. So the way I look at it, Do the story that feels right to you. Do the story that you feel is being true to the Star Trek universe, and let the chips fall where they may. You can't. Mm-hmm. You can't win.
Are you saying that what they're doing in Discovery is their Kobayashi Maru?
Basically, yeah. I really do feel that way.
No, I get that. You're right. You have to move forward. You have to be able to cut your teeth and say, you know what, this is the universe that we're going to move forward with. I don't think that they're necessarily disrespecting or not honoring what came before, because let's take a look. I got to give props to the prop department here, because the props in Star Trek, probably more so even than the uniforms, these are like the most iconic designs in Star Trek. Let's go all the way back to the cage and let's pay respect where respect and credit where is due. Because Wat Chang, he was the one who designed the phaser, the tricorder, the communicator for the original series. And those have been iconic ever since the original series was launched back in 1966. But when you kind of take a look at what they were doing with Discovery, they even do this in the credits. They take the original design, kind of devolve it and deconstruct it, and then reconstruct it into the design elements that they're using for this series, which, again, are designs that are supposed to take place 10 years, maybe even 20 years, because military technology evolves in that way, to what we're going to see 10 years into the future of what they use on the Enterprise. So the prop master, Mario Moriera, he explained it in a way on this really cool Discovery featurette. It's a video that you can see online. They respect the props as more of a period piece approach to creating new props for the show. When you saw these in these little individual video snippets that they paid really serious attention to and focused on, probably more so than anything else in their marketing junkets, did you feel like, yeah, these guys really kind of know what they're doing deconstructing these and kind of making them look like something that Star Trek would feel like, say, 150 years from now, if we were going to kind of timetable that from this point on moving forward? Kevin, how did you feel about seeing these iconic designs redone in this way?
Oh, they were totally paying attention to everything here. Just little lines into the phaser and how you have the little tiny top phaser that looks like it can pop out as well from the old ones. You know, and of course they have to kind of make it a little more modern looking too, but still they stay true to the original design, which I thought was very, very important. And they just make them look beautiful, and it makes you want to have all of it, you know, sitting on your desk, you know, doing a cosplay. I mean, they're just beautiful.
I'm glad that you focused on the phaser, because Mario describes the phaser as the quote-unquote crown jewel of the Star Trek Federation's arsenal of weapons. And it's about as iconic gets. It's kind of like looking at a classic car from like the 1950s, you know, 57 Chevy. It has a very distinct silhouette. Everyone knows a 57 Chevy when they see it. And no matter how you redesign a phaser, phasers from the classic series, the original series of Star Trek, have a certain look, very kind of art deco design aesthetic. Kyle, when you took a look at these props, were there any props that screamed to you disingenuous, or they didn't really pay homage to the original series? Or did you feel like, you know what, if they designed the original series now, this is what I feel like these should look like?
You just nailed it on the head. I'm going to just say this right now. The props that they are using in Discovery are the best looking Star Trek props ever made. I think they pay such great homage to where they've came from, but still have this new, fresh look to them. But it's all the little touches. And it's such a pleasure to watch. And there's nothing on here that I would see in, like you said, Norman, if they were to start Star Trek right now today, I would have no problem with this stuff looking this way. I mean, granted, you know, they are trying to pull from the past and keep the tradition, but they've done it in such a beautiful way. And I think this is one thing that the people who are showing hate towards Discovery, they're missing out on this. They are missing out on this beauty and this great artistic work that's in front of them, with how hard these prop masters are working to give us these amazingly beautiful props.
Well, one last thing. That's a great point. And one last thing, Kyle and Kevin, I want to ask you before we switch over to discussing a couple of other things. Because a majority of the fans, and I think that I can say this correctly, I think the majority of the fans came in with The Next Generation and then kind of cascaded into Deep Space Nine, into Voyager. A lot of that design aesthetic comes from what Herman Zimmerman, again, and Doug Drexler, Michael Kuda, and Denise Okuda brought to the 24th century. We're still dealing with the 23rd century with this storyline. So do you think that a lot of those fans, which are still the majority of the major fan bases out there, have a little bit more of a difficult time seeing not their technology being involved with Star Trek because the phasers look different. Obviously, the tricorders are different, and the communicators were buttons on their chest, essentially. So when you see like a flip-up communicator, there's an era of Star Trek fans that are probably a smaller percentage now of fans out there, kind of like the original series fans that go all the way up to maybe Star Trek The Undiscovered Country, where they actually flip the communicators open. So do you think fans are kind of rallying against seeing that technology, no matter how good it looks, Kev?
I think so in a certain degree. And I know there's a lot of people that saw the free trial run of Discovery. And then, you know, they were honestly, I think they were quick to judge and they gave it up. And of course, there's a lot of us that stayed on board. But, you know, when you look at these phasers, I'm going to stick with the phasers here. When you look at the original series, other way up through the movies of the original series crew, what's funny is I've always thought those designs were better than the handheld phasers used throughout TNG. You know, especially with like the first Dustbuster versions to the other slimline ones, because tactically. The phaser designs for the original series in here in Discovery and also Enterprise, they're more practical, especially when you need to aim and fire. From someone who's used firearms myself, they're just better designed as opposed to the ones that in TNG. And you know, I love the way they look on TNG, especially when they kind of streamline them a little bit later on. But you know, when you're trying to aim with those, it's not like aiming with the actual type of gun that the ones that you get out of the phaser here. But you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I've heard some fans kind of complain about, you know, like, you know, they wish they would see something more TNG like, but, I like the design. Honestly, I like the phasers, when you look back on the series, you know, of the original series. And of course the ones you get out of the movies and, the original crew movies, and especially now in Discovery, these are really good looking designs.
I agree. Kyle, any last thoughts on the props?
Again, I just got to reiterate, I think these are the best designs that Star Trek has done for their props. And I think it is a great homage to classic Trek and the timeline, but it's something I think that's throughout Discovery. I think Discovery really does get a good balance of some of that more technology with that some of the next gen people want to see, but I think it's more with the ship itself than it is with the props, where the props are really what give you the feel of classic Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting balance that this Discovery has, and it's what makes Discovery stand out on its own two feet. And I think, again, they're just doing an amazing job with Discovery. As far as, again, I go back to the prop side, the costume design, everything. I think they're doing a great job of making Discovery stand on its own, but playing such great homage to it.
I just want to say something real quick to you. I want to really give a shout out to the props department for Lorca's room, you know, his ready room.
Oh, yeah.
His room. Whatever you want to call it. That's one of those rooms that I wish that they would recreate, just like the Enterprise D bridge they did in Star Trek Hilton years ago, that I wish you could just walk in and just look at everything like a museum. And I really got to give it to them, because I wanted the camera to spend a lot more time just scanning that room.
So are you saying if Star Trek Las Vegas recreates that room, would you come?
Yeah. And hopefully I can put on the Gorn helmet. That'd be nice.
Oh, you want that Gorn helmet so badly. We're going to have to find a 3D printer to do that for you. A couple last things I'd like to say about the props. If you feel that what we're saying doesn't ring true, really take a look at what the prop department did in the finer details. Take a look at the three beam emitters on the phaser. And compare that, right? And compare that to the three beam emitters from the laser pistol from the cage. Or take a look at the respectful way that they incorporated the pip design into the Delta badge on the uniforms.
Very subtle. I didn't notice that until recently.
Right. So they're taking a lot of these design aesthetics and trying to make sense and amalgamate a universe that they have to move forward in, regardless of whether or not they're going to think that people like it or not. That's just what designers have to deal with on a daily basis. One last thing, and I'm going to put this out there for our audience to answer, and I'd love to hear your emails about this. Why the split delta? That's all I'm saying. I don't understand the split delta. I am accepting it because that's what it is. I just don't understand why there's that split in the delta where you've never seen that before.
It hasn't been explained yet.
No, it has not. No, it has not. So I'd love to see what is happening with that. And as much as we enjoy talking about the gorgeous stylization and the world building that's happening on Star Trek Discovery, I think that we still have to do our due diligence, pay respect to all of the kind of vibrant and colorful eye candy that's happening on the Orville. So as much as we love looking at the design elements on Discovery, I think that just in the same respect and in the same breath, we have to give a lot of respect and a lot of credit to what's happening with the production design and the costuming and the props on the Orville. Because let me tell you something, for a brand new series, the world building of this was fully formed at the very start. And I think that has a lot to do with poring over the costume details. You guys can't see this in the notes. I try and write as many puns as I can in the notes. But poring over the costume details is a little bit of a play on words because Joseph A. Poro, is the costume designer on the Orville. And Kevin, you and I have said this on many, many episodes of here on Discoville. Kyle, I think you've mentioned this too. If there's one thing that they got right from the outset, was the world building and the structure and the rank and file of the Planetary Union's costumes, because they are perfect. They are perfect in every sense of the word. And unfortunately, unless you're looking at still photography, you can't really see all the great detail that's happening on these costumes. And these costumes have caused so much uproar in the fan community that there are fan organizations out there that they're trying to recreate the costumes right now. Anavos has the license to do Star Trek, and they're all caught up with that in Star Wars, and that's fine and dandy, and they're doing their great thing. They make great products, but I really wish that they would take a look at looking at the Orville, because I think there's a movement that's happening here. And not only just the Planetary Union duty uniforms, but Joseph Poro designed the unisex designs of the Mucklins, kind of like the ultraviolet insect-looking kind of like armor of the Krill. He designed the Navarians, the Brodians, all that gorgeous costume work that Charlize Theron wore as Priya Lavelle when she came on in that episode, Priya. And then that really cool costume that's kind of cheesy looking, kind of awesome, that Isaac wears as the Kalon. So there's this design style that he's defined from the very beginning that builds this universe and builds these cultures in the Orville. And you believe that from the get-go, I think that this is a very, very realized universe. Kyle, let's start with you here. When you watched the very first episode and you saw, say, the Admiral's uniform, Ed Mercer's uniform, and then you saw the crew on the Orville and all these different ranks and all these different colors, what did you think when you first saw that? Did you think, this is something new to me, or is like, shades of TNG, or somewhere in between?
I would say somewhere in between, because I will say this. The costumes on the Orville look so much more comfortable to wear compared to the Next Generation costumes.
But we have seen Picard maneuvers with these costumes. Yes,
we have seen Picard maneuvers. But, I mean, to me, I think, and we've talked about this before, how we feel the Orville is what we would be if we were going into space right now with that. And I think these uniforms really reflect that because, yes, there's a bit of a military feel to them, but to me, there's always been like a bit of a comfort feel to them. I mean, you have the jacket that can kind of be removed with the costume. All of the costumes have a different comfort look to them. I mean, you look at the medical staff, especially Dr. Finn's costume, compared that to Ed Mercer's captain's costume, or even the Admiral. And I like the fact that they're using purple as for the Admirals. It's a color nobody ever uses. So It's nice to see that. And I think the costumes have this simplistic style, yet it works just so well. And then you look at the character designs from Isaac, and across, everything has kind of a simple feel to it, but yet it feels alien. And that's a great touch for, especially when you're talking about the first season of a show that who knows exactly how much of a budget the Orville had and where they decided to put the money to, and a show that wasn't sure what was going to happen with it. I'm going to be very curious to see going forward now what the production is like now that the Orville has been renewed and probably been given a bit more of a budget because of its success.
Yeah, you know, when we looked at this from a production standpoint, it looked like whatever budget they had, they spared no expense. I mean, I think that Seth MacFarlane knew that from the outset, and especially shooting in high definition, that things had to be fully baked coming out of the gate. Right, Kev?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that was one of the things that I noticed watching the Orville was just how well done the costumes were. And you could tell just by little things like in the epaulets and the sleeves and the way the jacket does unzip. And you also have the undershirts, too, that are matching to your rank that you wear underneath. And how you can unzip them and be a little more relaxed with it, too. But the costume that I keep looking at every time that wows me is Isaac's, because I'm looking at the actor when he does his movements and stuff. And I got to say, it's got to be I think they had to work with the actor to make sure that it was comfortable. But still, it looks like it's kind of constricting, but maybe it's just a good job that the actor's doing playing Isaac and how well he's moving and you know, he's able to run with it. And I'm looking at how the head kind of pops on the headpiece and everything. And it's just fantastic in all the detail. And I really, you know, we got to give all the credit here to Joseph Porro. I just wanted to mention that some of the movies that he was the costume designer for, Stargate, the 1994 original Stargate movie, Independence Day, and one of my favorite cult favorite films, and I love the costumes in it, was Equilibrium. And I think he was perfect for this design. You can definitely tell the detail in it. And yes, it does have a next generation TNG feel to them, but as Kyle said, they look more comfortable and easier to put on, because if you look at like a lot of those old TNG outfits, the actors needed help getting into those. Like they zipped up from behind the original. I think the ones with the pinstriping in seasons 1, 2 and maybe 3, I think it was at least seasons 1 and 2, and still moving forward that, you know, these, you look like you can put them on yourself. You don't need help putting these on. And it's just, I got to tell you, man, I hope Anovos or someone gets a contract to the Orville and starts making these things, because these, honestly, I think are better designed and better looking uniforms than I've seen in any Star Trek.
Kyle, you look like you're about to burst when Kevin said something. What?
Well, one talk about Joseph Porro's work on Equilibrium.
Okay.
But, you know, one of the things, too, I want to bring up, and it's something that's been happening a lot on social media with the Orville, is such close-ups people have been doing of the costumes and detailing the costumes. You know, they really haven't done that with Discovery, but they've done that with the Orville, because I think so many people are so impressed with how good these costumes look. Mm-hmm. And I'm very curious to see it, because I know you're big on and very excited for the thought of this, Norman. As now we know Orville's going to continue, the cosplay pieces that start to come out, the costumes that start to come out for the Orville. Eventually, you know, we got convention season coming up again, not that far, and I think you're going to see a lot of Orville this year, guys.
Well, I think one of the reasons why a lot of the fans are paying attention to it, one, is because there are a lot of fans of the Orville. I mean, let's just be honest about that. I think that the fan community is rising to the occasion, and they're sharing as much information as they possibly can. I actually posted a couple of screenshots when I was able to get good screenshots of the epaulets, like you said, Kevin, because they have details on them, like rank, file, serial number, their planetary union designation or their code, maybe security information for the ship. Things like that are what fans pore over all the time. And I think they're doing it a little bit more for the Orville, because the fan community isn't as big as Star Trek, not yet. You know, Star Trek always has this giant fan community. But also, I think that we're a little bit more grassroots, so that we have to find ways to share information to replicate these uniforms, because we don't have the big contract yet with any of these major vendors that are creating all the props. Because, you know, you have places like, you know, QMX, or Anovos, or the Wand Company that are creating these great props for Star Trek, but we don't have anything yet. We have a book that's coming out in January for the Orville, and that's so far it for any kind of official merchandise. So I think that if the fans get together and start rallying and making a plea for bigger vendors to produce these things, then we can get like big costumes. Then we can get like a big noise, and then we can make things happen like, I don't know, smaller fan communities and conventions and eventually become and take over the planet because the Orville is amazing. So, you know, we wanted to touch a little bit on the next generation. I don't think it's any secret that anything that pretty much came out of the 90s, you know, had a very kind of feel and look and flavor to it that was kind of colored by how long did the next generation went from 86 to what, 7 years? So that's 87, 7 years, 94. Then you had the Deep Space Nine overlapping that. Then you had Voyager overlapping that. So everything kind of looked like the Federation, no matter if you tried to design away from it or not. You know, if you had a colored jumpsuit, it's Federation-esque looking. So I think that Seth was smart. He kind of like played to the strengths and he made just more comfortable, brighter looking, more jewel tone kind of uniforms.
I'm glad you mentioned it. I liked how he didn't get into the jumpsuit look that DS9 and Voyager and also the... It felt like the movies, the Next Generation movies got into more of kind of a jumpsuit look. And I'm glad he didn't do that.
Yeah, me too. And you're right. The way that they are able to go off duty with zipping things down and just kind of becoming very kind of casual when they were hanging around watching Bortus almost karaoke, or when they were hanging around and watching Alara kind of come to terms with facing her fear, it went from duty to not duty so quickly. And I think it makes these characters more accessible.
All it takes is one zip of that officer's coat, and then, you know, it's casual.
Right. And one last thing here before the costumes is that I love all the costumes, but I love Claire Finn's medical smock probably the most. I think it's so sharp looking, right? And she wears it so well. But aside from the costumes, though, another thing that really informed us about this universe and, again, came out of the gate fully formed and very well thought out were the props. From the blasters to the comm scanners to the phaser rifles, which we finally saw in Firestorm.
The ship.
And the ship. I mean, everything there seemed like the Planetary Union has been in existence all this time. It didn't feel like you're adding things on to make the world and the world building more fully formed and more functional. Everything that they have, from the equipment belts, which are kind of like Star Trek, because every time they go on an away team mission, they have an equipment belt. They have the necessary technology that they need that looks like they've known this technology all this time. Kyle, you were nodding your head when I started mentioning the props. This is something that's important to you.
Well, very much so, but there's one thing, especially with the Orville. Greatest prop design ever, and that is their communicator tricorder combination.
The comm scanner, yeah.
The comm scanner. I mean, something so simple that we all go, why didn't Star Trek do this?
And also they have the communications device on the ship built into their wrists on their uniforms.
Yeah.
Which is really nice.
And I think that's one of the things with the props with the Orville. And I mean, they all look so sharp and original, but they're all so practical. And one of the most practical things, and I saw somebody on Facebook, and I can't remember who brought this up, post, I think it was on the Discoville page even. One of the great things about the Orville that makes it feel grounded with something they admit to, they admit to there being a bathroom on the ship.
Oh, man, yeah. Can we talk about also that kind of grand staircase that's on the set there? You get to the bridge, you go up and down that staircase. I love that.
Oh, we saw the staircase, yeah, between up and down on those levels. But we also saw that same staircase in Mercer's quarters when he kind of ran up and saw that Kelly was with Drillo.
Yeah.
And keep his dagger. Yeah. So there are nice practical effects that are happening on there. But I think the one thing the one person that we need to give credit to, and I'm not sure if he's the only person that's worked on the props, but in according to the IMDb page, Nathan Longest, he's the props fabricator, and he's worked on a lot of very big Hollywood movies, Kev, right?
Yeah.
John Wick 2, baby.
I thought you were going to pick up on that.
Star Trek Beyond, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're dealing with people. I mean, Seth is very smart. He's dealing with people who know their craft, who can bring something of a new aesthetic, you know, to this. And I think, again, like you were saying, Kyle, one of the things that fans really like, they feel like they can hold these in their hands, that these are tangible props. Across the board in science fiction, we love being able to collect these, to use them, to make them, to find 3D printed, as you know, schematics of them. And I think that it was very smart for Seth to have all this stuff ready to go and in the world so that people know that this universe is very solid. If you could persuade any of these merchandisers that we talked about to make one prop for you, I think you've just already mentioned that you would go for the comm scanner. What would it be, Kev, for you?
What prop?
Yeah. Would you like to see the blaster, the blaster rifle? Because we kind of went goo goo over the blaster rifle when we saw Alara pull it out of the locker at the end of Firestorm.
You know, I think the one that's used the most that Kyle brought up is that their own little tricom thing, you know, that's the communicator and the tricorder thing all in one.
Right.
Because I love how that thing pops up and it's translucent, that little light thing. Mm-hmm. Cause you know, everyone has that with them all the time, right. You know? Those blaster rifles are so darn cool. I mean, those are all really cool. If you don't mind, I'd just like to take a quick little, unscripted plug here that you and I are a part of this other Facebook page called the Orville Uniform Costume and Cosplay Union. Uh-huh. I suggest the listeners check that out. It's a public group because there's a lot of people that are really paying a lot of close attention to the costumes, and people are doing their own 3D printing of the pistols and stuff like that. Those phasers. Check out that page. It's called the Orville Uniform Costume Cosplay Union. It's really, really cool. And it's one of the, Facebook pages that's really active in trying to find, you know, when people are trying to build these from scratch, people even finding the right fabric for it.
You know, too, and I'm also a member of that group, and that was a great group. But I do have one kind of prop knock on the Orville, and it's just something that is a personal thing that kind of just drives me nuts. And it's actually more of a set prop than anything. It's the fact that in the lounge of the Orville, it looks like the cheapest office furniture ever.
Oh, you mean in the commissary?
Yeah, in the commissary, yes.
Yeah. But for some odd reason, I think it works.
It's all, you know, that press board wood. And
yeah. It is funny.
Though. And they've got a bar back there, too.
Yeah, it's kind of like they have their own 10-forward/Neelix, you know, kitchen/... commissary there. We'll see what happens in season two, because we had a new budget, and I mean, hopefully with a new budget, they spend it in the right way and they just keep developing these great costumes, these great props. We've talked a lot about the Planetary Union and how fully formed and how well and fleshed out that world is. But let's look at the other props that they've made. I mean, for say the Krill weapons, the Krill costumes, the latex aesthetics of the makeup and the appliances there, the way, and especially in that episode Krill, the ships, all the different things that go in there, because that takes an entire other mindset to design this kind of a world. So, and that all, you know, that's all part of this great art department. I can't say enough about how good that is.
And the costume for the Krill, especially James Horan, the guest star who played Sazeron, mm-hmm. the high priest, mm-hmm. his costume was just brilliant, just really, really cool. And for those of you who haven't listened to it yet, go back and listen a few episodes ago. We actually interviewed James Horan and talked about his experience working on the Orville and getting behind the makeup again. But yeah, the Krill design, I just thought was really, really cool, specifically Sazeron.
So if there's one last thing that you guys want to, say, see in season two that you haven't seen yet, in terms of a prop or in terms of a costume, what would you like to see? Maybe like, I don't know, like Ripley's power loader, you know, or I mean, we saw this in Discovery. They had like really cool body armor for their away teams. I don't know, lightsabers, you know, something. Is there something that you like as a prop, as a fan of props, you would like to see?
I'd like to see like maybe a type of knife to be used, you know, or some type of like away team, not necessarily like a holster or something, but like maybe a backpack and some tools. And also too, I want to see more Planetary Union starships. Mm-hmm. I want to see some different designs because alluded to in the first episode, they had, 3,000 ships to staff or something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
I want to see more of that as well as some other alien design ships too.
I think for me, it's something we actually have already seen in Discovery. I want to see an EVA suit for the Orville. We kind of get the oddball one when it's in the first episode and Ed is talking to Kelly and the guy keeps washing the window. But I think it would be very interesting to see an episode where, and I know it's kind of a trope episode, but where one of our crew maybe gets stranded in space in the spacesuit for a little while.
Oh, kind of like Jubal Early at the end of Firefly. It's like, yep, yeah. Well, exactly. Here I am.
couldn't you see that with like Bordas or something like that?
Oh my God, that would be amazing. Just Bordas and his personal log, and he's like stranded for hours, and all of a sudden they replay his personal log. It's like one word.
Yeah.
You know, it's like...
And he starts singing the Celine Dion song to himself.
You know what? And he's about to sing it. He's like, and if I have to do this one last time, here's my final performance of... And it just like ends.
You will be silent.
Oh my gosh, so good. Oh, so good. Well... You guys brought up a couple cool ideas, actually. We were talking about some of the visual effects, things that we would like to see. And again, that's another topic that we would love to cover because the visual effects for both Star Trek Discovery and the Orville, another topic of conversation for a future episode of Discoville. So usually it's around this time when we activate the Omega 13 device, but since we don't have a new episode for either Discovery or the Orville to talk about this week, we're going to be kind of keeping the Omega 13 boxed up a little bit because, you know, as they said, it's like, you know, I hold on a second. Let me find a box for it before I get it to you. So we're going to leave it in the box, and we're going to go straight into subspace signals. So on our subspace signals topic for this week, where we like to discuss either listener feedback or trending social media topics, and this one was trending pretty darn well, on November 24th, Marina Sirtis, who everyone in Star Trek knows as Counselor Deanna Troi from The Next Generation, she tweeted an image of herself sitting at dinner with Seth MacFarlane, or in between Seth MacFarlane and Halston Sage. And she wrote in her tweet, "I would post this pic on Instagram, but since the upgrades, I can't figure out how to do it." And she had like a frowny face and an angry face. But this is something that everyone, I think, in the Orville took notice of because this is Counselor Troi and Marina Sirtis, an alumni of TNG and alumni of Star Trek, with Seth MacFarlane, the creator, producer, executive producer, and one of the cast members. What do you think this means? The speculation is rampant now on social media. Kevin, let's start with you.
Oh, man. Yeah, the questions were going in my head were, are we going to see her character if she is going to be on the Orville in the next two episodes, with the season finale, or we're going to get something more in season two. I love how Seth MacFarlane and his crew are going to Star Trek alumni, and being Star Trek fans, we love this, you know. And I would love to see her, even if she was like, you know, a commander of some sort or someone's relative. Or some cool alien. We know that she can do it all. You know, we like Face of the Enemy when she played the Romulan, you know, and TNG, which was probably her best episode.
Yeah, totally agree, man. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because if you look back on all the Deanna episodes, the writers, I don't know what it was, just didn't really write them very well. But that one was perfect. That was just like the best episode for her. And we know she can act. She's wonderful. And Seth, being a huge fan of TNG, I'm hoping that teases something. I know you've got some ideas you'd like to see her in.
Well, wasn't it the first time also that we heard about the Tal Shiar? Because she was Tal Shiar, wasn't she? The Romulan secret police.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was so good in that. And everyone's like, where did this come from? I didn't expect that from her.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great episode.
I do have a few ideas, but I'd like to hear what Kyle thinks about this pick.
Well, first of all, this is a great topic because there's one thing I've really noticed in social media and just seeing it out there is how warmly these actors from Star Trek have embraced the Orville. And it's across the board. I have yet to see anybody from Star Trek give the Orville a disparaging word. And I think season two, we're going to see a lot of Star Trek guest stars. They may be just quick little flash roles. Maybe they're made up as an alien and they just have a brief appearance, or they play a major role in an episode. And I think Marina will be on an episode. I don't think it's going to be until season two, mm-hmm. however, because I think season one has been in the can for a little while. And with the aspect of the fact they are cutting off an episode of season one and making it the premiere for season two, makes me wonder if there's not something pretty big filmed and they're saving that to be kind of a massive cliffhanger for season one. Now, too, I think one of the things is that it's just a matter of time before we see Patrick Stewart on the Orville. I think his relationship with Seth MacFarlane, I think by the end of season two, we see Patrick Stewart on the Orville.
See, I don't want to see him as Patrick Stewart. I would love to see him as maybe like Yaphet's father and just have him voice a blob.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. When I say we see him on the Orville, right? it could be in any way. But yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, I love seeing them out of their element, because I was thinking like, okay, I'd like to see Marina Sirtis maybe play like the Krill Empress, if there is such a thing. I think she would look awesome in that makeup. Yeah. I'd love to see Brent Spiner either voice or be a part of, say, another Kalon, because
That'd be so perfect,
right? You hear like the slight differences, but a lot of people kind of, you know, they poo-poo Isaac a little bit because they're like, well, it sounds just like Brent Spiner, and they're trying to rip off Data. I'm like, so what? I don't care. And it would be awesome if
we need to see a Kalon episode anyway, and that would be great,
big time. You know, if he was like the Kalon consciousness, kind of like this motherboard, you know, of the whole Kalon empire, whatever it is, and it's him. Wait, that would be hilarious,
guys. No, I've got the perfect one for you. We get Avery Brooks playing a Hawk character on the Orville.
Heck yeah. Kind of like a dude, you know. Okay, so if you're listening,
can't believe you went there, Kyle. Go
there.
That's awesome.
Go there. Because this would be awesome, right? If in the 29th century he was Priya's boss and he came out of another wormhole in a flying white Mercedes or BMW, right? Mercer's got to pull that
little time travel device out of his drawer there and use it too.
Oh my god, that would be amazing! And that's right there, folks. That's the fun of watching the Orville, man. The sky's the limit.
Okay, I got to ask you guys something real quick. A little unscripted here. There was something on the Orville Facebook page that I thought was interesting, and they said, if you could change one thing from the Orville, what would it be? And you know what the common answer was, and it was mine, was more episodes, like longer season. Everyone wants like a 22, 24 episode season next season. Yeah. Real quick, what would you guys like to add?
I would probably say, yeah. You know what? I would actually like to have seen an actual two-parter.
Cliffhanger type thing. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, because it's just, you get to... Every episode is its own self-contained episode, which is great. And that's what Seth MacFarlane wanted to return the series to. Just like you can come in, jump in, drop yourself in, enjoy it. And there's not really a lot of continuity issue involved. But I would like to have seen like a Menagerie or Best of Both Worlds or something of that effect, where you have a nice cliffhanger-y type of episode. That's all.
What about you, Kyle?
I would like to see more episodes. However, I think that they are pretty settled in at that 13-episode run for the Orville. And I think that's why it's getting... love from Fox, because at 13 episodes they can give it a good budget without going crazy, and I think at 13 episodes it's also a lot easier for them to get the occasional bigger name guest star than trying to get fill guest stars for a 22 episode season.
You know, that's a really good point, because when you look at things like, say, the BBC, like Orphan Black, when you have shorter seasons, I think you actually appreciate them more, because you're only getting a finite amount of content and you don't want the content to be, I guess, you know, kind of vamped out, stretched out with filler episodes.
Yeah. And I think we have so much content out there right now. The shorter season, I think, is becoming more successful for keeping viewers because, yeah. I'll just to get off topic just real quickly, Kevin and I talked about this with Stranger Things season two. He got so distracted by things like The Punisher and a few other things that he kind of forgot about Stranger Things season two. And then he had a hard time getting back into it. There were other reasons involved, but I do think that was.
Yeah, there was a lot of other reasons.
But that, I do think that was a contributing factor in that aspect, is that you get so sidetracked by other things. So I think that shorter season is actually, with the way we absorb our entertainment now, really the way to go.
No, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. And I think that's a great topic of conversation for a future episode of Disco Bill. But for this episode, it was a great time talking about the props and the costumes and the world building and all the great things that have created these great layers in these universes that we love in Star Trek Discovery and on DiscoVille. But these aren't the only shows that we've been talking about here on the Fandom Podcast Network. And here are a variety of shows. I mean, we have a lot of shows here on the Fandom Podcast Network and a lot of different topics that we've been talking about these last few weeks. Recently on Blood of Kings, we released episode 57, actually very recently. So Kevin, would you like to let all of our listeners know what happened in episode 57 and what's coming up on this and all of these other fine shows on the Fandom Podcast Network?
Well, this was part three of our four-part look back at the wonderful weekend that was the Highlander 25th Anniversary Gathering Convention. And we were guests on a panel about Highlander and social media, and that just came out today. And then the following week, we have the part four and final, the celebrity interviews that we did for Blood of Kings. And we both had a great time, and we're still missing everyone that we saw there and our experiences. But these episodes have been great to relive that and to bring back all those good memories and such. So, yeah.
And what's happening on Culture Clash, Kyle?
Well, Culture Clash is bringing you the latest and greatest in pop culture news, reviews, and whatever the crazy things that are going on. We, in our most recent episode, Kevin and I talked a lot about The Punisher and Justice League. It was a big weekend over the holiday and the last couple of weeks with comic book related things, and it's going to keep coming. And of course, the countdown to countdown to Last Jedi is on the way, and it might be time to start counting down a certain Ready Player One as we get closer to March of next year.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, do you guys feel like we might have to revisit the book at some time and kind of get everyone primed for what they should be expecting for Ready Player One?
Yeah, we do.
All right, I think so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm about ready for my 10th listen on that audiobook, man.
well, kicking it back in time and going back to some of the things that we loved, we have what's happening with Time Warp 1987, Kev.
Yeah, we're going to be recording part four, the final chapter of that, looking back of all the films in 1987, which was 30 years ago, making us feel old. And we're now in the holiday season right now of the movies, and there's a lot of good movies that came out during that time that we're going to be looking forward to and sharing with everyone there at Time Warp. And also recently on Halloween, we did the Buffy the Vampire 20th anniversary special, where Kyle and Aaron Gill laid down some serious Buffy knowledge.
Yeah, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is just going to one of those shows that I think it always will withstand the test of time. It's a quality show. It's one of those shows that, you know, we just love kind of watching anytime that we're on the couch channel surfing. And speaking of on the couch channel surfing, we have Couch Potato Theater that celebrated a couple of really fantastic, what we call the defining the Couch Potato Theater moment, where you would have, hey, the Blu-ray special or the Criterion version, but you know what? I can't get off the couch because I'm too damn lazy, and I'm just going to watch it right then and there. What do we have on Couch Potato Theater?
Oh, we've got, recently we did Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner, celebrating, of course, the recent sequel, Blade Runner 2049. And also we have Doomsday that's out. We have both the retrospective to the 2008 film starring Rhona Mitra and also the commentary. And Kyle, I know you've got something in the works.
Yeah. With it being December, it's time once again to pay a visit to our friendly doctor. And Davis Grayson sat down and did a great Couch Potato Theater on the American Doctor Who special, which focused on the Eighth Doctor, played by Paul McGann. And we've got some stuff there. And, you know, Kevin, something coming up, too. I got to ask you, what is the deal with the boots?
What's with the boots, man? What's with the boots?
Pay attention later, everyone's and you'll like, know what it is.
everyone's like, what are they talking about? What's with the boots?
I'm in suspense. And speaking of suspense, don't you guys like my transitions?
Be beautiful.
Oh, that was good. That was good. Yeah.
Well, speaking of suspense, we have Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast with Tom Caldwell, Brandon Shea-Mutala, and Chris Haig talking about the works of the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. And even more suspenseful is what's happening weekly with the National Football League and a podcast you guys take the helm of called The End Zone. What's happening on The End Zone, fellas?
Mediocre fantasy football advice. That's what's happening.
Oh, you know, that's what I wanted to ask you. Like, I want you to trademark that so I can put that on a t-shirt, because I think that's the greatest slogan ever.
And mediocre football as well with our teams.
Things have gotten a little rough around the season, but I do know this. Kevin, do not let Aqib Talib near your necklace.
No, right? Oh. Well said, sir. Well said.
And on that note, I think we're going to wrap this one up. So I'm Norm, and behalf of my fellow shuttle podcasters, Kevin and Kyle, thanks everyone for listening. And join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Discoville. Hailing frequencies are now closed.